Welcome to another episode of Bowel Sounds, a pediatric GI podcast, the official podcast of the North American Society for Pediatric Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition, or NASPGHAN. I'm Jen Lee, pediatric gastroenterologist at Nationwide Children's Hospital, joined by Jason Silverman from Stollery Children's in Edmonton, Alberta. Hey, Jason.
Hey, Jen. How's it going?
So good. I want to talk about your experience at NASPGHAN this year. How was California for you?
First of all, it was great. I always have a great time at NASPGHAN, seeing so many friends and colleagues from across North America and even outside of North America. But being back in San Diego was extra special this year because San Diego was actually the location of NASPGHAN the year that I had Teaching in Tomorrow. And Teaching in Tomorrow is such a sort of foundational experience for so many trainees as they're getting interested in pediatric GI or getting into the community. And I have really fond memories of spending time in San Diego and NASPGHAN that year. And so it was really cool kind of coming full circle and even seeing many of my Teaching in Tomorrow cohort at the meeting and talking about our experience at Teaching in Tomorrow and reminiscing. So it was fantastic.
That is fantastic. I love it. You know, I think for me this year, I have not been to San Diego in many, many years. Love that city. It's so walkable. Went running by the bay. And really special for us this year was receiving the Terry Lee Education Award, Terry Lee Young Educators Award from NASPGHAN. One of the highlights when we went up and received the award, thank you so much for all of the fellows who actually had Bowel Sounds merch. And they gave us a standing ovation when we went up to give the award. So thank you, fellows, for supporting us. And it was a really cool surprise to see you all dressed up that way. And I'm actually sitting here in front of these beautiful flowers that came from Hawaii on behalf of Dr. B. Lee. And it smells phenomenal where I am. I wish you were here to enjoy it with me.
I'm just going to have to live vicariously through you, but they are beautiful. And so thank you, B. And thank you again to NASPGHAN, to our listeners, and to our amazing guests. And it's just an amazing honor. Hearing more about Terry Lee made the award even that much more special.
For sure. And you know, I think today our episode is even more special because we are doing our very first NASPGHAN year in review, which for those who don't attend NASPGHAN or haven't been in some time, this is an annual lecture that's given at the plenary session where we kind of review the top research that's been highlighted in the last year.
Yeah. And anybody who does attend NASPGHAN knows that this is often a big highlight kickstart to the beginning of the meeting. And it's a rapid fire session reviewing all the top articles. And it's something that lots of people look forward to. And it was so great that this year we got to sit down with Dr. Sandeep Gupta, who's editor in chief for North America for both JPGN and JPGN Reports, our society's sister journals, and walk through many of the articles and his inspiration for doing the year in review talk that he gave this year.
We can't forget to mention he's at the University of Alabama, where he is the professor of pediatrics there. And he's also an endowed chair of pediatrics. So we were so grateful to have him. And it gave us an opportunity to ask him some difficult follow-up questions on the things that he highlighted. So really looking forward to sharing this episode with everyone. On to the show. Dr. Sandeep Gupta, thank you so, so, so much for joining us in person at NASPGHAN for this very special episode of Bowel Sounds.
Hey, thank you so much, Jen and Jason, for having me. It's an honor. I was waiting for this day.
We can only imagine how busy you are as editor of JPGN and the NASPGHAN editor of JPGN Report. So we really appreciate that you were able to take the time to sit down with us in person for this.
Yeah, for sure. There were lots of go-arounds for scheduling this, so appreciate it.
And I appreciate you doing this at the annual meeting.
But you can't get away from one of our hardest questions. So I know you and Jason know each other well, but I am just meeting you. So for myself and for our listeners who don't know you, how would you describe yourself in one sentence?
Am I allowed to give a preamble? Or is a lawyer question only one sentence? Or can I give a story behind it?
Sure.
Yeah, a lot of our guests are tripped up by the one sentence thing.
Okay. I can give you a sentence, but I would like to frame it. And in one word, I am an educator. Mm-hmm. But the story a little bit behind that is, before I give the one sentence, is I always wanted to be a teacher. In fact, when I was growing up, I would have a chalkboard in my room and the toys around me and stuff, and I'll teaching them and mock exams and stuff. And my mom said, bless her heart, that she wanted me to be a doctor. And she said, doctors also teach, so why don't you become a doctor? So here I am, but at heart, I really am a teacher. And I think that's why I've stayed in academia. But in one sentence, I would say I love to educate, engage, enable, empower, and elevate. I think that really is who I think I am.
I love that. It's kind of like we should have given him a word count, yeah. Like we get.
All with the letter E.
All your intro, and then the body was great, right? Within the word count.
I'm sorry, you've gone four characters over.
Teacher and me.
Yeah. So this is another question that is helpful for actually all of us, because this is someplace I've never been. I know you have relatively recently moved to Birmingham, Alabama, and I've certainly never been there, and lots of our listeners, I'm sure, have never been to Birmingham, Alabama. So now that you've had some time to get settled in Birmingham and get a little bit of the lay of the land, if someone was coming to visit you in Birmingham, Alabama, what do you recommend to do? What's a place that we need to go and see, a restaurant we need to eat, our food we should be eating? What would you say we should be doing?
No, that's a great question, and I don't think you're the only one. In fact, prior to this move, I have been in Indiana for nearly 30 years, so 3 decades. That's a long time. And I had to move to the Southeast because of family reasons. My parents are elderly, and my brother lives in the Southeast. We wanted to be close by. So I had actually called Mitch Cohen. I had known him for years, and he's of the chair of pediatrics, and to see what jobs were available in the Southeast, not even knowing much about Alabama myself. And he said, hey, we are looking for someone, and one thing led to another. I think I would be totally in the same situation as you just described. Most of us who haven't been to Alabama, that it's like going to India. I'm originally from India, and go there without any preconceived notions. Go with an open mind. It is not what you read or hear is liberal in areas, conservative in areas, very social, progressive. We are such a tapestry of people, races, colors. Yes, no place is utopia, but Alabama is not any different than most other places. Mountains are close by, three hours away. Atlanta is couple, 3 hours. Beaches, depending on where you're in Alabama, you could be on the beach.
I love the beaches in Alabama. The Gulf Coast beaches are so beautiful.
You got it. Or you can be in Huntsville, one of the brains of NASA. So it depends where you are in Alabama.
Awesome.
Very cool.
Yeah. That is so great that you have had a good experience moving down to Alabama. So now let's move on to our topic. So this is a very unique episode. We really want to talk about the year in review. And this is where, you know, you discuss new papers in 2023 to share with the listeners of NASPGHAN. And honestly, this is one of my favorite parts of NASPGHAN. I don't know about you.
Oh, totally.
I just remember my first few times coming and just being so inspired by what is presented. So, but you haven't been doing this forever. So can you explain what is the year review? What's the purpose of it? And what is it like filling the shoes of Dr. Ballesteri, who's done this for so long?
Right. He's an icon. And, you know, those are one of those things that you just aspire to be. You can never be. And this actually, I think somewhere along the way, this I believe is my fourth or fifth year in review. I think fourth. I think some years ago, and I could be wrong, people who know history better would know, but Dr. Ballesteri and then the editor of JPGN, Mel Hyman, would each do a year in review. Yep. And then when Mel stepped down and I took as editor-in-chief, then I started doing it. And I think it was basic science and clinical papers. That's how it was. Mm-hmm. So last year was, I think, among the first times where Dr. Ballesteri and I both did it. And I showed a slide with a weighing scale where his was so much heavier than me, little me there. He's a tough act to follow.
Yeah.
And he told me, you know, you never want to follow in the circus, never want to follow the elephants because they mess the place up. So,
I think that was a poop reference.
Perfect for the podcast.
Right. So I've never really felt that I am filling his shoes because those are impossible to fill, but rather just tagging along kind of stuff.
Right. And so when you are sitting down to put one of these talks together, what's your approach to picking your articles? Like, what is it? You know, we were talking a little bit before we started recording about, you know, the fact that we're telling a story, or that you're telling a story with this presentation. So how do you choose your articles? Like, because that's what we all loved about the year in review, is we get told a story about the year that was in GI science.
Yeah. No, very practical question. And as I look at it, so normally I go from September to August, September of 1 year to August of next year, because I have to put some boundaries on what literature, and I don't repeat things. So now I have started collecting all my journals, and in June next year is when I will go through them. And I don't go there month by month, because then I forget the trend. Something that is published in April next year might be connected to this year's October, but I would have forgotten. So in June is when I start tearing all my journals up, and they're piled up in my house till then. And the aim is to give a broad breadth of, you know, topics. Like, each year you are not able to get something. Like this year, there were a couple of things I couldn't get to, and people come and tell me that. So,
wait, like what?
So that kind of, you know, so, and I kind of create a story that I think I'll give the credit to that to Jim Squires, because he is my to-go-to person for hepatology. And each year he says, this is the story you can create. And he picks up the articles and stuff. But I get input from all, I'm so blessed in that way. I get input from all the associate editors, the editorial board, colleagues. So, because I don't read all the literature, there's no way I can. But people send me articles. And there were a couple this time that were quite basic science. But at least five people send me those papers. I'm like, okay, I need to do those papers.
So I'm going to drill in a little bit more detailed on this, just from the standpoint of, our listeners, hopefully they keep submitting some great research to JPGN as they have been doing. But if they want their paper to show up in next year's year in review, how do you choose the specific paper? Like, what stands out to you about a paper that says, yeah, this sounds like the kind of one that I want to promote? Does the infographic help you choose the paper?
Are you just plugging that because of your social media role, Jason?
They do help. They do help and attract attention. There's no doubt about that.
Now, that's a great question. And, you know, sometimes I sit and reflect on what made the paper. I think it's more that even though there'll be 3-4 slides on each subject matter, I don't want it to be so fragmented that the listener doesn't get a depth of that subject matter. So it's more how it creates. So a paper from New England, a paper from gastro, a paper from this, but to create a story. Like in the disparities talk we did yesterday, the section, there were papers from like 3-4 journals with 3-4 diseases, but they all had a theme. So it's, yeah, the theme is what I'm looking for. But obviously the paper has to be good too.
Yeah.
For sure.
So now that we've gotten some background, we have to give you a little bit of harder questions. Okay. So in the very beginning, you showed a slide of an astronaut sitting on the moon looking at the Earth, and that's kind of the level that we're going for. So we're just going to have some conversations about each specific topic. But I really want to start with EGID. So I know that wasn't the order that you went through, but I think a lot of us have read so many of your papers on EGID and absolutely, the up-to-date article on EGID. And so just to kind of kick us off, can you talk to us about eosinophilic GI disorders and what has been exciting in the past year?
No, thank you. I think this field, you know, I've been doing this since 94, And 95 was our first presentation at DDW, and we got the fellow prize for it. This field has changed so much in the last 1 year. From 1994 till 2022, it was diet, PPI, steroids, you know, just whatever combination you could do. And since then, the dupilumab coming out, the severity scoring system, which needs field application and testing, the consensus statement, just the cohort of people around in this space has been very exciting. But I think even more exciting, I think the EoE part has kind of become passé, kind of. It is the non-EoE EGIDs that are really taking center stage. The gastritis, the duodenitis, not so much the colitis.
Yeah.
So it's really seeing a progression of knowledge from a very small area to actually...
Like literally top down?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So I do want to give a shout out because I'm so excited to see all the trainees here.
Yes.
And there was one poster in particular that talked a little bit about one of the papers you highlighted. There's a fellow at UC San Diego named Andrew Dickerson, who gave a presentation at DDW and a poster here about IC and some of the clinical applications you talk about. So just curious, what do you see about this clinical guideline? And do you see it coming to clinical practice soon? So based on the last year, should we start using it today?
You know, I think I would say yes, if it can fit into your system, especially in an EMR, because it is at least semi-objective, if not a fully objective, fully cleaned up criteria, at least a starting point. Till now, it was all very subjective and no standardization. So this brings some standardization to the whole process. As I was preparing for the postgraduate course talk on EoE therapies and then the year in review, I actually reflected that this score could help longitudinal monitoring of patients and also prediction.
Right.
And both of those concepts came out in a paper I showed at the postgraduate. It was multi-center, UC San Diego, Colorado, and UNC, where they retroactively applied the IC score to 111 patients who were part of two randomized clinical trials. And then they just saw how the scoring was able to look change longitudinally between baseline and pre and post 8 weeks of steroids. And also it was able to predict histological endoscopic changes or dilation needs. So.
Okay. And Andrew, that was your paper, or not your paper, your topic.
And can I just ask, because, you know, since there has been this top-down progression from EoE to EGID, for the people that are still stuck really focused on EREFs and know about EREFs as it applies to EoE, what does IC stand for?
I see.
Or what does it mean? What is it that we're tracking?
Do you still use both?
That
you
score?
Mean like should we use both? We should, right?
Yeah,
because they're different.
So that
no, you're right. EREFs is an endoscopic scoring system.
Yeah,
and IC is a composite score of the symptoms, endoscopy, and histological changes. So it's kind of taking the patient as a whole.
Right. So it's a bigger it's a bigger picture look at what's going on from an EGID point of view.
Right.
But everybody should really also look at the slide that you had about dupilumab and the step-up therapy versus when to use that first. I thought that was very clear. Mm-hmm. And I really like that there's some guidance on when to think about using it.
Yeah.
Right. You know, that's like giving somebody a big toy and like not giving them instructions how to operate it. So suddenly our world turned upside down in a way for a better, I think, for families and patients on May 20th last year when the drug got approved. But we really didn't have a playbook.
Oh, it's kind of like when we're here at NASPGHAN and Jason was giving me the equipment to record this and we were trying to go through on how to
use it. A quick walkthrough of how to set this up.
Shall we move on to the next topic?
Yes, absolutely. And the next one is a topic that is a struggle for lots of people, both children and adults living with this condition, as well as the providers who are trying to help them. So the obesity medicine space. So what's new in the last year in obesity medicine?
Right. Oh, my goodness. Hasn't that world changed also like never would have imagined? You know, I used to run the obesity clinic at Riley some years ago. We used to call it POWER, Pediatric Overweight Education and Research. we wanted to put a C or a K in it to for clinic, but then it became poker, and that wouldn't have gone very well. So we kept it as power, and you know, it's always like that same thing, like the EOE, PPI, steroids, diet for obesity. It's like eat less, be more active, and just go in circles. Till last year, well, this year when the new guidelines came from AAP, and I think empowerment of the providers that we can consider pharmacotherapy and surgery at a younger age. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one can argue pharmacotherapy was always there, some drug or other, but we really got empowered with GLP-1 agonists in the market. And so bariatric was always there also, but this has, earlier you had to have closure of the epiphyses or menarche or stop growing. And, you know, just there was so much if, buts, and when you can do it. And by the time you can do it, the child has lost half their growing years and mm-hmm. their social life. We are 16 or 17 before you can't do anything. So I think the guidelines have really changed that a lot, and the drugs and the studies that have been published recently. And I was just super excited, literally super excited. And that's why I presented, even though it's a September article in New England, but I broke my rule of stopping at August, but went to September with the oral GLP-1 drug. Yes. I can't pronounce it, it's a very complex name, but I was like, and the outcome was similar to the weekly injections.
That's right. Amazing.
My mind, simple which, mind. Which, as we know, for managing children, you know, even adolescents, if you have the option for oral therapy over subcutaneous injections, I mean, it's a game changer.
Game changer. Right? Yeah. Well, and should pediatric gastroenterologists be prescribing this, or this is a broader impact than just in peds GI?
No, that's a great question. And we have been having discussions at our institution. So that's why I can weigh in a little bit more, because many places have the obesity program.
Yeah.
Like we have the SHINE program. Then the endocrinologists are prescribing for the A1s for the diabetes. And then we are doing for NAFLD mm-hmm. patients who have or mm-hmm. the metabolic
state. Wait thing, a second. Yeah, right? We're going to get to that in a minute. Should we still be calling
now? So, and then we just had a meeting recently at our institution. It's like, we don't want to have so many entry points
yeah.
because the providers in the community and the patients will get so confused on who can give me GLP-1. And then there'll be no consistency on who is monitoring and collecting long-term data.
Oh, mm-hmm. wow.
So in answer yeah. to your question, yes, we should prescribe. But I think we as a community, if not global, at our institutions should look at how do we want to handle this drug that touches multiple points.
Yeah.
That's important.
No, that's a really good point. And we were talking after your talk at NASPGHAN this year that this is probably a topic for a future Balsons episode, because the development in that area is huge with new guidelines, new injectable therapies, new oral therapies coming down the pipeline. Might have to give it just a tiny bit of time for more data to come out, but I think the game has changed a lot.
For sure. And we really need to understand that and the side effects of it too.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, okay, we're going to move out of order a little bit, because since we did bring up NAFLD and fatty liver, I don't even know if we're supposed to call it these things, but let's move on to hepatology. So tell us what's new in the liver space.
Right. And so last year was so super exciting with the IBATs, the bile acid transporter drugs. And this year was the nomenclature where we had to learn a whole new alphabet. And we might be having a topic of the month coming out in JPGN where the terminology, when I looked at the figure, it's under review, so I can't say more, but the figure was, I wish I could have shown it yesterday, but I can't because it's not published yet. The terminology and how it impacts us, because not all the terminologies like the alcohol liver disease might impact our patient population. So, but we have to learn that terminology. It was a little bit a tongue twister, but I think as I look at it and read more about it, I think it's a better standard of putting literature out there. Mm. The other was really cool. You know, I did my residency fellowship in the late 80s, early 90s. And in those days, things like Alagille syndrome, alpha 1, really, I mean, you have a baby with jaundice, all you do is biliary atresia kind of rule out for the most part, because quote unquote, and you know, it's take it with a pinch of salt, there was not much we could do for most of the things. So I was super excited with this alpha 1 antitrypsin small study, but mm-hmm. you know, hope Yeah. And the technical variant graphs, that's something I learned a lot about while reading that paper. I was not as familiar with that update in liver transplant as I became after reading that paper.
Wow.
And presenting it yesterday.
A lot of new stuff. I feel like more Bowel Sounds episodes coming soon. We got to write these
there
down.
There are always. I have to say, every year since we've been doing the podcast, we attend the year in review, and we send so many text messages to each other while the talk is underway saying, that's another episode.
Yeah, yeah.
Another episode.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, but on the nomenclature paper, you showed a really nice figure that talks about, you know, categorizing cardiometabolic disorders. And so I think I want to make sure to push everyone to that. So if there's one thing to look at paper-wise from this entire presentation, go to that paper, look at that little infographic. I think it will be really helpful for the future.
You're right.
Yeah. And we should include some links to PubMed listings for some of the articles
that
we're touching on in the show notes for the episode.
That's a great idea.
So we're going to move on to an organ that I have some affection for. The missing P from NASPGAN, the pancreas.
Oh, there should be two P's. Is that what you're saying?
So can you give us some highlights here? I mean, the one thing that I remember is, PPIs. You mentioned earlier about within the space of EOE, but talking about pancreatitis associated medications.
Yeah.
And we use a lot of them in our field, commonly give them out, discharge from hospitals. So what do these findings from this review of pancreatitis associated medications mean for us in our practice?
No, that's, that struck me also because I never thought drugs that you would consider so innocuous like PPIs could be a pancreatitis associated medication, a PAM, PAM. And so that was an eye opener, but I thought it was important to present that paper for three reasons. A, there was a 19%, about 20 some patients who had pancreatitis associated medication or exposure. And then, so that was one to increase awareness. But secondly, the number of people who were on the drug on admission and at discharge. So, is an opportunity there.
Yeah.
At the same time, I think we need to be a little mindful that may not be the only reasons. These drugs are not they were the reason in 19%, even though 50 to 60% of the drug were on drug.
Right.
So it was not the cause of pancreatitis in each and every one, but they may be a cofactor.
Right, right. While you were talking about drugs that may contribute to the pathogenesis of acute pancreatitis, you also presented on something that might be therapeutic in the setting of drug-associated pancreatitis or pancreatitis-associated medications, or PAM. What was that?
That's such a, and that just tells the power of people. So I was running through, because I did not have that slide earlier in my early iteration last week, because I ran that with a few friends, a dry run, and actually my colleagues at work. And they said, instead of this slide on pancreas, why don't you put this slide on the asparaginase associated pancreatitis? And I said, but that's a very complex paper, and I don't know if I can do justice to it. But the more I thought of it, it made sense because, again, the theme got created from the medication part to another medication. So I reached out to Sohail Hussain, and then we kind of figured out a slide that would do justice to his very deep work.
Mm-hmm.
And the interdisciplinary nature of that paper, the multi-centeredness. I loved how they data mined EHR. It was not just mouse and human, like bench to bedside, but with EHR, which I thought would be a great message to the younger, or to all of us in the audience, that there's such big data out there.
Mm.
So, and that's something else I try and do with the topics I bring out, is what is the next step? Is there something in this paper that is going to move the field forward, or have somebody think about a project they would want to do?
Well, yeah, because vitamin A should be pretty easy to administer, right?
Absolutely.
I can imagine a study for this pretty easily.
Yeah, yeah. I think that group is planning some studies in it.
That's great.
Yeah, and again, a great message to send that sometimes this retrospective review of big data sets helps foster what the next step needs to be, which is the prospective trial to actually prove that it's not a made up association.
Yeah, for sure. Moving on to celiac disease and IBD. So I was laughing when you did that because this is just an example of how high level this urine review is that you clumped those two categories together. Can you tell us why you did that and give us the overview of that space?
So the paper on celiac disease, actually, you know, I remember it clearly. It was just a striking paper when it came to JPGN. Multi-center, several centers involved, large number, 800 patients with trisomy 21 with duodenal biopsies. That's huge numbers.
Huge.
And so we worked with the submission and the authors and made it to where it was. And I'm really proud of that paper of bringing out, again, it's not for the perfectness we are looking for. We are looking for moving our field forward again and how to help patients better. So that paper, you know, when it was complex doing all the percentages and the numbers. So as I was preparing for that talk, I'm like, I need to put a solid number because the percentage was getting so lost. So out of the 400 some patients with abnormal biopsies, it was shocking. A quarter of them, 117, had abnormal villus atrophy that was not celiac related.
Wow.
So I was shocking. And then, you know, obviously it was a retrospective study, but they felt exposure to acid suppression was more common in those with non-celiac villus atrophy than celiac villus atrophy.
And interesting.
That might be another angle to study further.
Yeah. And it made me think clinically too, because often our patients with trisomy 21 have a lot of complicating factors, congenital heart disease and other reasons that might make us not want to put them under anesthesia. And so, you know, I'm just curious to see how that might change our practice in the coming years. What about the JIA updates with IBD? That was fascinating with when you went through the different medications that might, you know, that were seen more frequently in patients who have IBD. Can you talk us through that?
Yeah, that and the other paper also on IBD. So this paper, I wanted to highlight that we learn from each other a lot. It was a study from Germany with 5,000 JIA patients. So, you know, we are a one world, one family, and that we should really have open, that we just don't do the best, or only I can do it, but all around us can do the best. Mm. So that was one reason I wanted to highlight that it was a small number who developed IBD, but what struck me was the medication part, as you pointed, Janice. Sulfasalazine exposure increase the risk and methotrexate. It,
wow.
You know, yeah.
It's
so observation, very fascinating.
Yeah.
The other paper was actually sent to me by one of our former fellows, Michael Foreman, and he wanted this paper. He said, you know, he have used this paper to counsel and educate families on biologics, on staying on the first biologic, what chances are there, the risk for stopping biologic. And he point in the supplementary table material that, you know, often I don't read after I've done reviewing the paper. You know, I'm just glossing over. So that just showed the highlighted for all of us that sometimes there's a lot in the supplementary material also.
Right. Absolutely. So even though IBD and celiac disease are both two massive areas of GI practice, you can tell some stories about what happened over the course of a year. And that's what makes this talk so great.
Well, and you know, that's actually, I got to bring up the informatics thing because you know I always do. But one of my colleagues in informatics at Nationwide is a rheumatologist. And when you were putting that up, I said, oh, I got to send that to her immediately. So nice. I will be sharing that paper as well.
Thank you. For sure. And next up, we have a very important and very... It's becoming a very timely topic, and that's the topic of disparities in medicine. And we're certainly seeing more and more, justifiably, more and more publications looking at the differences in treatment or outcomes related to certain socioeconomic factors and identities. So what stood out to you this year in that space?
I think what stood out in the papers I presented were, especially in a couple of them, you know, sometimes you see papers on disparities that say, okay, this group A did not have endoscopy for abdominal pain like group B, but it did not go in deeper for the reasons or explained it more. So I think, or the downside effect of it, and I'll bring out three papers out of those that I show that really highlighted for me, and one more that I did not show if we have time to, if I have a permission. The one on the pancreatitis, nearly 6,000 episodes of pancreatitis, and it showed very clearly that certain race, non-Hispanic blacks, have multiple issues, multiple disparities, opioid exposure, IV fluids. I mean, those are such basic things. Longer hospital stay, higher cost. It went deeper than just saying, African-American patients did not get this, but it just showed me the downstream effect of it. Same for that, the elective and non-elective admissions for failure to thrive. It showed us that, yes, some patients have non-elective admissions, more commonly black race, public insurance, but it carries a burden with it. Longer hospital stay and less feeding tube. Same for, well, for the eosinophilic esophagitis, the reason I presented that was, A, that was among the largest cohort of African-American children with EOE. Mm. And then it also showed the patient's characteristics, which we can then use in clinical practice, but also that there's a risk of non-adherence, higher risk. Mm-hmm. So, and there was another one that I didn't show was the death of patients with liver transplant mm-hmm. after transition. It was higher. Black race was a risk factor for death.
Right. Wow. It's really important for us to know the data, and then that fosters the next program of research of why is that and how do we bridge that gap and mm-hmm. how do we stop seeing papers on disparities because we don't have any.
Right. And you know, I'll take that to put a little plug about the journals is that if you look at our editorial board, it is such a gem. We have more females on the editorial board than males. And beyond that, we have different ethnicities, races, geography around the country, Canada, institution size. So I think we have really embraced diversity and disparities in our journal. And as you know, we'll be starting a section editor for diversity and disparities also.
Wow.
That's great.
That is great. So I want to talk a little bit about food and nutrition. Huge topic. We are so happy. Again, I got to plug Nutrition Pearls, the podcast. Yeah. We're so happy to have all of our CPNP colleagues here. Walk us through what's hot in nutrition these days.
Yeah, there's so much happening in nutrition and kind of goes in waves. This year, I found it was a little bit challenging to find some literature, solid literature beyond, yeah, but I really felt that what we presented were very family and patient-centric, changing the diet of children by providing resources to the family, I thought was very meaningful. Susan Baker had sent me that paper, and then the one from Journal of Pediatrics on the burden of care on families. It's mind-boggling, 29 hours a week on average to spend just taking care of the tube feedings and tube care and medications.
Yeah, as someone who works in this space, I see it nonstop. Time commitment in families that are looking after our kids that are on home PN, it's a huge burden.
Right, and then you look at those questions, I think 10, 11, 12 onwards about difficulty with communication, healthcare access and stuff. Those are things we should be able to help families. We can't go to their house and change the tube or the buttons, but at mm-hmm. least we can help them reach us.
Yes.
Yes. Easier.
Absolutely.
For sure.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I noticed that we also had that position paper come out shortly after that other publication. Can you tell us a little bit more about the position paper on the ESPGHAN Committee on Nutrition?
Right. Yeah. That, I thought that was a really fun pictorial for us to carry, many of us being educators. with a nice little diagram of the complications of parenteral nutrition and surgery. And the complications sometimes may not go away even after you have weaned off the parenteral nutrition. Mm-hmm. So that was a very strong message that stopping the therapy doesn't mean that side effects of therapy may not still happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very important. And I liked your takeaway slide that this is sort of a call to action for us to continue to advocate for our patients
for
in
sure.
this space.
Yes.
So I have yet again a bit of a downer topic to touch on.
Do you think I did that on purpose?
I kind of do. But you raised another important concept, and that is of distress in our patients. Now, of course, we know that our patients in certain scenarios, they're in, you know, scary situations. They've received diagnoses that they may not understand. They're undergoing different therapies. What struck you this year in publications talking about the distress and stress that our children that we're seeing are under?
No, I think those were some of the papers that many colleagues suggested that I present. So, and I think they're related in a way. That's why I grouped them together. There was one from a multi-center first author from UCSF on pediatric medical traumatic stress, and a third of the patients being in scary situations or traumatic medical interventions or just, you know, being young. These are entering an OR is so easy for us, but entering an OR as a 12-year-old for even a scope is so overwhelming with those big machines and six of us all gowned and masked is traumatic. Mm-hmm. So AA showed that about a third of the children, 36%, had PMTS, but also that they carry this home. You know, sometimes we think the world is around the four walls of the hospital, but there's a big world out there that they go back into after the 30-minute visit. And the functional impairment, the opioid use, the quality of life, I thought was very important. A message to bring out for awareness. And then the other two papers, one was the tonically engagement of the EC cells in females, might explain DGBI more.
I mean, that was, I literally had to like take a second take for that. Right? That was so cool.
Yeah. And I love the figure in that article to Jason's point earlier about, you know, making it engaging. It's like that figure was colored by itself in the paper, blue for men, pink for ladies. And it was so easy. You take a look at that figure and you exactly get the message right off the bat.
Yeah. And it might be a step closer to understanding, you know, why we're seeing this more in females. Over males.
Yeah, absolutely.
Before we move on, though, I do want to ask you, there was one paper you talked about, the connection between stress and GI inflammation. Mm. I really thought that was important for us to highlight as well.
That's a fantastic, fascinating paper on how they really did that basic science, so to say, stress, increased steroid levels circulating, then affecting GI tract by increasing TNF-alpha and TGF-beta, which cause inflammation and dysmotility. And then they go the next step and actually test it out in patients with and without stress. And those who have stress have more chance of getting IBD and have higher inflammatory markers such as CRP. And as the stress level increased, the colonoscopy score worsened. Yeah. And it was just fascinating that they just brought so much out. And then in my mind, I'm like, okay, should stress management be part of IBD care or any chronic care?
Yeah. I mean,
I think it should.
Absolutely. I mean, we're always strapped for our psychology colleagues' resources. And, but I do think it makes sense. You know, we talk about concomitant therapy for managing IBD, but maybe psychologist needs to be part of the concomitant therapy.
Oh, for sure. And I do want to give a plug because I think we're realizing this. even my children who are in elementary school right now, they're actually learning some techniques like diaphragmatic breathing and things within the context of their school. So I love to see that now, that they come home and they'll get worked up about something and then they'll say, oh, mommy, I got to go to the corner and do some wolf breathing. I'm like, oh, okay. Or square breathing. I'm like, wow, okay.
Nice.
And so I just love that. I think everybody can benefit from some of that stress management.
For sure.
And actually, we have a psychologist for that reason on the editorial board, not for us, but to help us evaluate the manuscripts. So we do have a psychologist also.
So not to help you with the stress that you get from having to choose which ones come onto the year in review. Okay, so interestingly, general GI, like the hot general topics in GI, were almost at the end of your presentation. Walk us through what's new in general GI.
I think that segment I made specifically patient-centric, things that can affect patients. One was on the IBS diets, that yes, you know, there are different diets and they have some difference, but overall they were similar in efficacy, and that the patients actually found the traditional diet the easiest. So maybe we need to step back. More may not be better each time, you know. Mm-hmm. Obviously. Well,
then, yeah, we're adding to the stress that we previously just talked about.
Exactly.
There you go, right? And then the really cool study from Nationwide on the Constipation Action Plan.
Thank you. And shout out to Kate Hawa, who is the fellow that really championed that paper, and several of my colleagues that were on it. Thank you for including that.
No, yeah, actually, I reached out to Kate before the talk. So a lot of background work happens to get the slide just right. Because unlike Kate, your entire table about red, green, and yellow talks about C table 4. And I see table 4, but it's all with asterisks in there. And then she told me it's an epic thing, document, and you can personalize it. So then I could give that to the audience. And so a lot goes behind each slide to make sure that the message is delivered in a useful manner. And the third was on the foreign bodies, that it was an Italian experience, but I thought it was important to share what their experience is, which may not totally align with our guidelines. And that's okay. But I think it's important to know that they did not have any complications on the sharp foreign bodies.
Including that patient experience and empowering patients, I think, is a theme that we need to continue clinically just moving forward.
Absolutely. And I really like that you included that Italian foreign body paper, because I actually included it in a Hot Topics in GI talk that I did earlier this year at the GRIT course for the Canadian Digestive Diseases Week. And what I liked about it is, you know, all of us have had foreign bodies, including sharp foreign bodies, that have not been able to be removed endoscopically for a variety of reasons. Either they had already passed, you know, distal to the pylorus by the time that you are notified, by the time you're able to see them. And so it is very comforting to know that, you know, take a breath. It's okay.
Yeah. I know, for full disclosure, Marsha Kay on Thursday, the day before, I'd done the postgraduate talk on foreign bodies, and she showed the NASPGHAN guidelines. And I called Marsha after her talk, and Marsha, I'm planning this slide tomorrow. I just want to make sure I don't give mixed messages to the community. So again, showing you that, you know, a lot of thought goes into the slide and the message.
I love that. And I also love great minds think alike.
Yeah.
The same paper.
See, there's something to that. Yeah. So I somehow this landed on me to bring up. We did not plan this, that Jen brought up her paper or the section with her paper. And I'm about to bring up something that I'm on. But we can't go through 2023 without talking about AI. And certainly you brought it up. So what is it that you wanted to share with the NASPGHAN audience for the pediatric GI community in the space of AI?
First of all, I want to share that, again, showing the power of people. This paper came out when Neil Lileko, who is one of the associate editors for JPGN Reports, brought it to our attention. Hey, we need something on AI. You know, because you get so busy with everything that you don't really sometimes see. I said, you know, Sandeep, you're in 2023, we really need a position from the journals. I said, well, let me reach out to the NASPGHAN colleagues. And I spoke to Dominique, and he said, yes. Then we said, okay, it needs to be a combined effort. It will be both journals. So we need representation from JPGN, JPGN Reports, North America, NASPGHAN.
Mm-hmm.
And that editors, Dominique and I, don't need to be authors, because Jason and others are doing the heavy lifting. So that just showed that how this paper came by. And I love how it panned out. I was just showing the potentials, but pitfalls of AI also. On our information for authors, instruction for authors, there is something about AI, but just this morning, three people told me that I think we need to relook at that and be even more clear. Just yesterday, I got an email from UpToDate that actually, their authors and editors and reviewers are not supposed to use AI, very clearly stated. So everybody is trying to navigate the space. We'll have to find what works best for us. But that's true. Definitely a disclosure from the authors.
Well, we were talking about this in the technology committee yesterday. And one of the things that came up is even in colleges, they're using programs to try and detect AI that may have generated the text. Right. And then didn't somebody say there are programs to then detect the programs and block the programs?
It's always a cat and mouse game. Yeah. It's always a cat and mouse game. But I think that it is really important to highlight that, you know, that unfortunately the genie is out of the bottle when it comes to this sort of newer wave of AI, the generative AI space. Yeah. And people are going to at least be interested in using it, and we can't ignore it. We can't act like it's not there, but we have to, as a journal, as a society, we need to put it in its right place, especially given the fact that it is far from perfect.
Exactly.
It's helpful, but far from perfect.
For sure. So, Dr. Gupta, thank you so, so, so much for being here. And you had the challenge because you basically gave us three takeaways for every topic that we did today. So I'm going to change this last question just for a minute. If you were speaking to people who are going to submit a paper to your journal, what are the biggest three takeaways that they can do when they're preparing to submit their papers?
Very interesting question, because this morning we had the Meet the Editors breakfast session and some of those things came up. I would say take a step back. You know, everyone's babies is perfect, and take a step back. Have one of your colleagues read the paper. Make sure it's understandable. You know the literature, you know the paper, you know the subject matter. It may look perfect to you, but somebody, your next door neighbor might like, what's that? Not because it's not good, it's just the clarity of it. So make it clear. That's number one. Number two is read the instructions for authors. There is some leeway, but, you know, there's a reason why the instructions are there. Any journal has theirs. And if you got rejected from one and you're submitting to another one, that's fine. But make sure you have taken the name out of the first journal, the cover letter and stuff. And we have all done that. And the third is, don't be shy. Reach out to us. We are servant leaders. You know, we don't own the journal. We are here to serve. So reach out to us. Don't be shy. We are here to serve you. One fourth thing I would add to it is, but when you're responding to reviewers, even though it's anonymous, but it's just like writing an email, just because a person is not in front of you doesn't mean there's not a person on the other side.
Yeah.
So be kind, be gracious. If you can't do something, just say so. Not be offensive.
Sure. And maybe the same advice for reviewers too.
Yeah. It's just treat your colleagues with the respect you want to receive yourself. Most of the reviewers are our colleagues. They may be anonymous. We may not know who reviewed our paper, but at the end of the day, you know, you may have just had coffee with them at the conference.
Well, and what I love about NASPGHAN as a community in general is that, you know, just being here this week in San Diego, I feel like everybody is lifting each other up and wanting them to succeed. And I really feel the same thing from the journals.
Actually, that's what I texted somebody in the Meet the Session, editor sessions texted me, Sandeep, I love the way the editors are all, you know, the session is going. He was in the audience. And this is the text I wrote to him. I love it too, because not only are each of us empowered, but we are empowering each other. In the entire session, I only had to step up one time to answer a question. All the editors knew the answers to all the questions, which showed to me that it is a very open community and the communication is so transparent. That's what I took from this morning.
I love that.
So, Sandeep, thanks again for joining us. The last question is, looking back at your career, you said over three decades now, what has been the most valuable advice that you've received? And what advice do you have for our listeners?
You know, that does make me reflect. You know, I came to this country literally with $100 and a piece of paper with a degree. Looking back, I did not get here just on my own, starting with Jeff Himes in Connecticut and Vic Herson, who was a NICU attending there, who so uplifted me, a foreigner with a different skin color, with an accent. So I think just reaching out and respecting people. And Stan Shulman, who was my director, who so supported me when I did a part of an ID fellowship at Children's Memorial in Chicago before it became Lurie's. And obviously Dr. Joseph Fitzgerald at Indiana, he is like a father figure, and he would make sure he valued people and he listened to you. If you want to learn about active listening, it's from him. He'll give you the full attention. And then when I was applying for this job, for this position as the editor, for the journal, a colleague told me, you know, give it as if you're writing your grant. And I think that has resonated me, and I gave that application all I had and more. And I think that's what probably helped me get this role, which is just, it again makes me a teacher, which flows in my blood vessels. So I would say follow your passions, but also be realistic and see what you can do the best.
One, I also love give your best.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And just recognizing that your best is, that's it. That is your limit. That is what you can do.
And one thing I want to pull back, my favorite thing that you said in closing was one of your key advices before, and that's not to be afraid. I remember writing my first paper as a medical student and just being scared with holding on to that first draft forever until I felt like it was perfect.
Yes.
And you don't have to do that.
No.
You know, you have co-authors who are going to help you review. And same, it sounds like the reviewers, the editor, that's what you want for this journal, is just to help make it the best paper that it can be.
No, yeah. And, you know, to that, I will say we spend more time before we reject a paper than we accept. So just to give you, a rejection is not an easy decision for us. We really spend a lot more time before rejecting.
More stress.
Yeah.
That's more stress.
Sure. That's the psychologist on speed dial, right?
Yeah. Well, Sandeep, I hope I can call you that now that we've gotten to sit together for an hour. It was so lovely to have you. Thank you again for taking the time with us at NASF again. And
thank you. I guess I should say see you at the next meeting.
So that was really great sitting down and talking with Sandeep today, going through so many of the articles from his year in review. I know I'm inspired to go off and read more details about lots of these studies and learn a little bit more about some of these things that may or may not be changing our field in the near future.
Yeah. And thank you, Sandeep, for choosing some articles that we were co-authors on. We did not plan that, by the way. We did not pay him, but we were very honored to have that, to see that up there this year.
For sure.
If you don't already, be sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @ValSounds and on Facebook at Pediatric GI Podcast for the latest news and updates on upcoming episodes. And if you like what you heard and want to support the podcast, it would help us out if you did all or one of the following three things. Number one, tell someone about the podcast. Number two, leave a review on Apple Podcasts to help others discover it. And number three, on the Buzzsprout page, there's a link to support the show by making a donation to the NASF Again Foundation. You can also get there by www.naspghan.org. The money you donate helps support some of the amazing things the foundation is doing, including supporting GI research and public education programs.
And we'll also have a link in the show notes for merch if people are interested in picking up any ValSounds paraphernalia. And as always, the discussion, views, and recommendations of this podcast are the sole responsibility of the hosts and guests and are subject to change with advances in the field. Thanks for listening,
everybody.
Thanks for
listening. Bye.